This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One. Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Fort Hunter Liggett. Come along and join me for a conversation with Garrison Commander Colonel Charles Bell. How are you?
Oh, I'm great, Tom. How are you?
Good. Always a pleasure to come on base.
Yeah, absolutely. It's always great to see you, and thanks for coming out and conducting this interview.
The reason I'm here is that you're a short-timer.
I am. I don't know the exact number of days, but I know on 30 June at 9 a.m. in the morning, we're going to conduct a change in command.
So in the Army Reserve, standard protocol is a commander does a two-year tour, and then they rotate?
That is correct, Tom. Yes, the 10-year for a commander, typically a commander that is a 06 commander and below, is 24-month tenure. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of our more senior commanders, our general officers, their tenures are a little bit longer, 36 months at the major subordinate command level.
The only downside for the 24-month guys is right when you hit your stride, right when you know where all the bodies are buried, they move you on.
Yeah, I like that analogy, but it's even more so in the garrison environment, in the garrison installation leadership environment. It really takes a year. It takes you 6 months just to figure out which way is up. Mm-hmm. And then after you finally get the terminology down and you understand where you can influence the garrison and make progress, by the time you get that rolling, it's time to go. And so to your point, it takes a long time to get anything accomplished just by the nature of what we do. Everything is very programmatic and funding oriented. And then once you do get it on track and get your priorities, which are the priorities to support the Army Reserve, mm-hmm. Once you get those on track and oriented and moving forward, it's time to leave.
So that being said, you have a new garrison commander coming on board. So it would seem to me to be critical for you to debrief and download your knowledge to the new commander before you take off, correct?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So we'll do a pretty in-depth. I use deployment terminology when I say RIP, and that means relief in place. Mm-hmm. So we'll have 2 weeks prior to the change of command where we will be working shoulder by shoulder, attending meetings together, allowing and affording her the opportunity to understand the organization, the organizational structure, which is going to be like none other that she's worked in before. Understand the workforce, get to know the workforce, and then start to digest the projects and initiatives that each one of our directors is moving forward with in support of our installation. Not just our installation, but our garrison. When I say garrison, I just want to throw this out for clarity. So when I say installation, I'm referring to our installation here, Fort Hunter Liggett. When I say garrison, I'm referring to our enterprise, which is two installations. It's our installation here at Fort Hunter Liggett, and it's our installation at Parks Reserve Forces Training Area located in Dublin, California.
So how unique and distinctive was your tour of duty here from what you had done before?
Like none other. And I think that would be the status quo if you interviewed every garrison commander, either in command or recently come out of command. Typically, my battalion command was an engineer battalion that had 7 organic engineer companies and a battalion staff headquarters. And so the similarities of the mission are very different. Here, it's really diverse. We're responsible for these platforms across both installations. We're responsible to make sure they're supported, make sure they have the right capabilities, make sure that not only our Army Reserve partners and really our sponsors, and that we're an Army Reserve funded garrison, have the capability they need, but also all of our other aligned partners, such as the California Army National Guard that trains here because we're convenient and we're located on the Central Coast, or any of our special forces, special operations, Navy Seabees, all those folks that are resident at training on our installations have what they need, and we're building capability to that degree.
So that being said, the big overarching umbrella is that this is a schoolhouse in every facet of technical training for the Army, right?
Yes, I would tell you we have a schoolhouse in terms of the garrison, in terms of the garrison or the mission of the garrison?
The mission, in that everything you do has to do with training and preparedness and simulated exercises, like what's going on right now today. I had helos dive bombing me coming on base.
Yeah, so exactly. To your point there, we're very much a transient training installation here at Hunter Liggett, mm-hmm. as well as at parks, but much less there. So when I say that, that means that units and soldiers rotate through and conduct and execute their training objectives and leave. If it's an individual, typically they'll come here and learn a specialty or achieve the next level of NCOES, non-commissioned officer education.
Specifics, for example, I'm thinking of military police. You have a schoolhouse for that here, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So we'll have military police, we'll have engineers, and we'll have multiple specialties under each one of those. So mm-hmm. under the engineers, we'll have the carpentry class going on, or we may have the horizontal construction folks or the combat engineers going on. And so that's really our bread and butter, military police, engineers, and PSYOP, which is information operations. And so those three courses are the mainstay. Now we're going to start teaching more and more transportation courses into next year.
Truck drivers.
Correct. Yeah. We did a proof of principle for that the year before last. And the new commander, the 80th Training Command, Commander General Bowles, is committed to initiating that course here. So I think we're going to see more and more of that.
And then, in addition, you have specialized training exercises.
Correct.
Right now, this week, you have what, CSTX?
Yes, uh-huh. The Combat Support Training Exercise. So, yeah, so that's the collective training. So, individual training, a mm-hmm. soldier comes
Colonel.
Out here, travels out by himself. He reports to the Army schoolhouse. When he gets there, he's enrolled in a course and attends that course and specialty and learns what he needs to learn. When a unit comes here, which is what you're talking about, it's unit collective training. Typically, when they come, they'll be participating in one of two or three different exercises that are going on throughout the year. So right right now, the combat support training exercise is one. And then in addition to that is a global medic. When we spoke earlier, you talked about the helicopters that you saw dive bombing mm-hmm. when you came in. Those helicopters are actually in support of Global Medic, and they are practicing conducting medevac operations at Schoonover Airfield. And there's a field hospital set up there, and that's in support of the combat support training exercise. And then in our northern training areas, we have what's called XCTC, or the Exportable Combat Training Center exercise, mm-hmm. that's going on in support of the 79th IBCT, which is the 40th ID, California Army National Guard.
And kind of translate some of the tangible, specific exercises they are involved in.
Right. So all of these exercises all have a scenario mm-hmm. that they're working towards, and usually it's large-scale combat operations, so it's going to be, you know, identify, find, and defeat the enemy in the case of our infantry brothers. In the case of our combat support training exercise, it may be more all along the lines of supporting the fight, right? Supporting the war fighters mm-hmm. who are oriented on the objective.
So as simple as logistics?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Logistics operations is probably one of the main components. We have some engineers that are part of that exercise that equally logistics oriented, and you know they're doing some combat engineer type of operation. So those are the type of units that would participate in the combat support exercise.
So 2 weeks ago, it was a sleepy time on base. Today, what do you have, 7,000, 9,000 troops on base?
Yeah, I think collectively, as we look across both exercises, we're probably right around 9,000.
Is it one specific division that came here, or is it a collective?
It's a collective. So the combat support training exercise is comprised of many units that are throughout predominantly the western region of the United States, traditionally Army Reserve units. And so those are the units that came, with the exception of our unit from Puerto Rico, which is our engineer unit. So we do have some units that are from far that attend our exercises as well.
A personal thing that I think is interesting is Schoonover, your airfield base, which is like a third world jungle strip, man. It's pretty rough intentionally.
It is, yeah. So the aviation units that fly into our installation, they need that training. And so the tactical airstrip provides them that training venue.
You have Travis Air Force Base that comes down and C-17s?
Correct, yeah. It gets a lot of use from JBLM, from Travis, from our National Guard, National Air Guard, California Army, National Guard, Air Partners, the 129th and their C-130s. So it gets a lot of access. A lot of pilots need that training, and it provides that venue.
Back to Colonel Bell's world. We're now winding down your tour duty here. Looking back, when you first came in, what did you mentally perceive as your biggest challenge, you know, the thing that you didn't even know if you could conquer? And looking back, some of your rewards.
Yeah, so when I first came in, I mean, like every new commander, you spend about the first 30 days just, you know, making some observations, right? You don't just jump in and change the dynamics of the entire organization. You take time to really observe where we are. And from my perspective, coming from an operational unit, I just felt like maybe we weren't operationally oriented in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And so I worked to change that. And I think it's changed for the better. It's taken a lot of focus and a lot of effort. I think it's paid us dividends as we talk about wildland fires, as we talk about COVID, our response to COVID, as we talk about staffing, manning, and operating the installation operations center that converts to an emergency operations center in time of crisis.
That distills down to something as simple as communication, correct?
It is, yes. Yes, it's communication and having everybody either in the right room or in the right room when it comes to teams, depending on how you're operating, because during COVID, we had to operate in a distributed environment. And I know COVID's still going on, but a large part, if not the majority of the installation has been vaccinated. And, you know, I'm thankful for that because that allows us to operate understanding that our folks are taken care of and they're taking care of themselves. And inherently, they're taking care of the team as well. But the operational, how we're operationally oriented was my one takeaway in the first 30 days. How can I change that? How can I change the mindset of what we do to provide that operational focus? So one thing that impressed me, I say, hey, you know, I came in my first 30 days, you know, I realized we needed to have more of an operational focus, realign some things and got there and are still build momentum, but are really on the right track. But what I didn't expect was to fall in on an organization full of some of the most professional Americans in the United States, most professional, God-loving country patriots and Americans that we have on our installation.
And one, I need to interject, citizen soldiers. This is really important.
Yes. Yeah. So a lot of them are dual military or they are civilians in the garrison and serve in the National Guard and Army or Army Reserve. But the caliber and professionalism of our civilian employees has been astounding. This is the first position in which, you know, in a tactical unit, you're going to go into the battalion. I remember going into a battalion or even a brigade, and I was the smartest guy in the building. I was the smartest guy in the command because I had lived it. I've been an engineer my whole career. There's probably not too much you could tell me about engineering and leading engineer units that I didn't know. In this organization, you are the dumbest guy in the room, and you have to rely on that expertise of your professionals, of your directors. And so you learn to respect them professionally. You know, I'm at awe by their depth of knowledge and expertise, but you also have to just understand that, you know, the vast majority of your directors have been in this line of work their entire careers. So the same expertise that I would hold if I was a brigade commander of an engineer brigade, they hold in their specialization. And, you know, we have the breadth of specialization. And then our employees is all just in general. It doesn't matter, you know, what their level. One thing that I recognize that we didn't do well is we didn't recognize our employees well when you talk about gaps. And so one thing that we set out about instituting was a recognition program for our employees. And so we've been able to do that.
When you say employees, these are civilian support?
The civilian, and then, you know, so, it could be military as well. Generally, in this position, I use employees because the vast majority of my employees are civilian employees versus the 30 military folks that we have assigned.
Right.
So we didn't do a very good job of recognizing our employees well. We do now. And I think in the military, we grow up and we develop in a culture that really makes sure we do a good job recognizing service. And so we do that here now. We've made it through 6 employees of the quarter. We have 1 employee of the year that was also an employee of the quarter. And so I won't, well, maybe I will read through them all. I mean,
sure.
We have Miss Lori Fash from DPTMS, Miss Jamie Edwards from PRIFTA, from the PIO section at Parks Reserve Forces Training Area, Mr. Clint Tull, our assistant fire chief here at Fort Hunter Liggett, Miss Talia Wesley, our force development officer here, Miss Stephanie Saunier from our G8, from our resource management section, and then soon to be Mr. Batista from our roads and grounds section, a relatively new employee and probably one of the hardest working employees that I've seen around the garrison here in recent times. And then our employee of the year, I mentioned Ms. Fash is our employee of the year. So typically we'll take all the employees of the quarter and then we'll have a board and we'll identify employee of the year. And so, you know, that's the one thing I want to make sure that we carry forward, that the installation carries forward, that we continue to recognize the hard work and dedication of our employees, because we have some of the, like I said, most knowledgeable professionals out there that are as committed as anybody else in terms of making sure that we provide the right support and we are, our installation has the right level of readiness to support our Army and Army Reserve. And these folks, without them, we couldn't exist because we couldn't execute our mission.
Looking back last 24 months, what are you most proud of that you did accomplish?
Well, you know, I talked about our operational posture, you know, our fight through COVID and wildland fires, which was supported by our operational posture, you know, recognizing our employees is one of, I consider, my strong accomplishments. But I would say just making sure that our focus is on our understanding that our ranges and our training areas have to be the best in the Army and the Army Reserve. And the aperture in which we all look at our ranges and training areas. So, you know, if units come here to train, they want to train on a modern range, and all of our ranges need to achieve a equal level of qualification based on, you know, the Army gives us some direction there on what the range needs to accomplish. And then making sure that the classes that come here, that the training areas that they have are, you know, as state of the art as they can be. And that doesn't always mean all the bells and whistles. When I say state of the art, I mean, it can mean something simple like latrines and bleachers and, right, and classrooms, but just making sure that that focus is there. So that has been my number one priority, right? Everything, and I've said this openly numerous times, everything else supports that, because without that, it's impossible. If we don't have a platform that supports readiness and units and soldiers building readiness, then we wouldn't exist. And then next would be our next, if not in line with that, would be our support to the community, because we have a base operations role. And we've somewhat struggled with having a sense of community. My first year here, I kind of felt like we were, I don't know, it was just disjointed. Mm-hmm. But with the Command Sergeant Major's assistance and the HHC command team's assistance, we went about with this idea of selecting community members to represent the different neighborhoods that we have here on Fort Hunter Liggett. So, and we called them mayors like many, many other organizations do. But these folks have been the driving force of our community activities and engagements. And I feel like in the last 12 months, our sense of community and the level of effort that our community members put into the installation is just, it's just grown.
Isn't MWR, or morale, welfare, and recreation central to that mission?
Yeah, it is central. Yeah. And so how this would work is, you know, you have a group of mayors, one that represents each neighborhood, and then they come to a meeting with ideas that they've solicited throughout the community. And then they work with MWR to support that. So here recently we did Trivia Night. That was a community idea that was brought forth by the community together by MWR. Just a phenomenal, something we didn't think of. And so it's ideas like that. It's the community telling us, the Garrison and FMWR, what they want to do, what they want to see, which is different than what we've done in the past.
But that's what makes a community, right?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. But I think it's really developed well. And I think if you would ask our residents, there is really a great sense of community right now and camaraderie across the Garrison. Everybody's willing to help everybody else. And it doesn't stop with just those folks that live in housing, because those folks that live in housing also work on the installation, right? So we all want to help each other, both professionally and personally.
Every time I come on base, there'll be a big poster about some cool barbecue at the Hacienda, and it's like, oh my God, I can't leave. I'll stay. I mean, every week it seems like you have some cool get together.
Every Friday or Saturday. Yeah. And again, back to the community initiatives effort, it'll be something different, right? Mm-hmm. So it'll be a luau, it'll be a trivia night, it'll be a karaoke, and, you know, all those things go to support our residents, but also, like, in times like right now, support our training audience that's here.
You're a relatively remote base. You just don't go out of the gate and go downtown.
No, exactly. So, yeah. So there has to be some type of activity, mm-hmm. but also it has to include food, because there's nowhere to go eat.
Well, time to move forward in Colonel Bell's new life. You're moving to Salt Lake City, Utah.
I am. As a matter of fact, my wife and son have already moved to Salt Lake City.
I wondered. I saw a Facebook post, and he's in Salt Lake.
Yeah, so we rented a house in a little neighborhood off from town, one of the older communities there in Salt Lake, but it's really close to work. One thing that I've learned from my time here at Hunter Liggett is it pays to live close to the office. Mm-hmm. And so my new home is going to be a mile and a half from my office. And here I was like 3/4 of a mile from the office. So I've doubled my commute, but nonetheless, I like to be close. I think there's a lot of dividends in that.
Tell us about the base, what its name is, and what its primary mission is.
So the installation there is Fort Douglas. Mm-hmm. And Fort Douglas was an active installation until the 90s, and it fell under BRAC. And since then, a lot of the Fort Douglas proper, what used to be Fort Douglas, was turned over to the University of Utah. And then what was remaining is I'll call it an enclave. It's an enclave of historic buildings, which are beautiful. But within that enclave are some pretty significant Army Reserve units. And so those units that are on the base, some of them are training here now. The 807th Medical Command is one of the major units there. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the unit that I'm going to, the 76th Operational Response Command, is another major subordinate unit that's there. It's commanded by Major General Miles Davis.
Your primary mission will be emergency response to a 9/11 or a major anything that happens that nobody's prepared for.
Yeah, so the mission for the 76th ORC, one of the missions is to provide a task force that's capable of providing mission command or command and control to an emergency response.
And so is it logistics coordination? How does it work and function?
Yeah, it's logistics coordination. And it could be, it's an all-hazards response.
It could be a natural disaster.
It could be all-hazards working in a DISCA environment. That's something that I've not done before that I'm really excited about. I'm excited.
You like challenges, don't you?
I like, much like coming here, you know, it'll be a new environment and something new to learn, which is always exciting. And, you know, historically, the 76's focus has been on training for the actual worst possible event, mm-hmm. and that's America's worst day. However, we've seen over time that as being a subordinate or being in response to our North, that the aperture is open to use the task force and the headquarters in different crises. And so we, the division, trains for the worst, but understands that, you know, a crisis is a crisis and the framework is the framework, and they may get call to respond to, you know, something less than America's worst day. Yeah. And so they remain, the headquarters remain on a 96-hour prepared to deploy order. A really high op tempo, a really great mission. It's a really great location. And the staff that I've met since I've been becoming oriented with the command are really top-notch. So I'm looking forward to getting there.
We talked earlier about communication, and you made me think back to 9/11. And one of the logistical disconnects was something as simple as literal communication between one fire department and another, or the police department. What efforts and priority have you guys placed on making that a non-starter?
Yeah, so communications within the task force, within any headquarters, is always paramount to getting the mission accomplished. And so I know the 76th, they're dialed in on that, and I can't wait to be part of it. You know, as a headquarters, they go through several iterations in a year, and then they validate annually. And that validation is good for a year, but in preparation for that validation is continual training, where they bring all the partners in, they get them synchronized, they're working in the FEMA and the NIMS DISCA framework. Everybody's dialed in. By the time they roll around to June, they execute their validation mission again, and it's externally evaluated. And so it's a practice. It's one of those things that's continually practiced. Mm-hmm. So if they did need to deploy and execute, it would be like old hat.
Like a fire department.
Exactly. Yeah. Very much so.
So again, I know it's a little amorphous, but looking forward, what do you think will be your biggest challenge, and what are you most excited about accomplishing?
Well, you know, my role there is I'll be the chief of staff for the 76th.
That'll
operational
be your title?
That will be, yes. Yeah. So that'll be my position and title as the chief of staff for the 76th Operational Response Command. And so with that, my major responsibility is to synchronize and move the staff forward and make sure that our two missions are supported. So we have two missions. The one that we talked about is our task force mission, and that is obviously very critical, and some may call it our primary mission. You know, like anything else, we have competing missions and competing priorities, and we just have to be good at both. And so that's incredibly critical to make sure that we're successful in that arena. And then in the second arena is our Army Reserve Command and Control mission, or we often refer to it as our ARC2 mission. And that is supporting our subordinates. And so those are subordinates that are aligned to our organization that we provide Army Title 10 authorities to, which means we man, train them, equip them, make sure they're ready to deploy. And so, you know, our responsibility as a headquarters is to make sure that all of that is taking place.
So it's more than Army and Army Reserve. By deductive reasoning, you have to have communication with Coast Guard, Air Force, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So it's all
responsible. It's all. And so that's under the task force mission. That's understanding that network and making sure that we're communicating up and down the chain. But also, when we talk about our Army Reserve Command and Control mission, those are all Army units or Army Reserve units that are aligned to our organization. And it's a very diverse portfolio. So it's not necessarily all DISCA-oriented type units. We have some really unique units by nature of our command. We have the EPLOs, which is the Army, the liaisons, the emergency preparedness liaisons that work with the states to understand the requirements. We have some space units, space elements. We have some AREs or Army Reserve elements that support major headquarters throughout not only the nation but the world. So very diverse mission sets. And then we have some more of our traditional units, which are brigades. So we have two chemical brigades that have subordinate battalions, and then we'll have a regional support group that has some chemical folks in it as well.
In civilian interface, cities, regions, states?
Yeah, all of that. So, you know, the beauty of being the commander of Fort Hunter Liggett is everything has been here or in California relatively close. And now I'm entering a world where everything will be all over, right? Our subordinates aren't all co-located in Salt Lake City. In the United States proper, predominantly. And our subordinate units are all over. One of our brigades is in Sloan, Nevada, which is just outside of Las Vegas. But the other one is in Greenville, South Carolina. So, you know, you can see the diversity and location. And then the Army Reserve headquarters is in Fayetteville, North Carolina, or Fort Bragg. And then the Army North headquarters is in San Antonio. So just
An interface with FEMA, correct?
With FEMA, with the different regions as well. And, you know, that really depends on if there's a crisis, where it's located, you know, what region you interact with.
Colonel Bell, before we go, parting thoughts.
Yeah, Tom. So first and foremost, I appreciate you driving up today and conducting this interview, and not just this interview, but all of the support you've provided to Fort Hunter Liggett, whether it's me or soon to be Colonel Lamb or before me, Colonel Norman. You've been a friend of Fort Hunter Liggett, and we greatly appreciate your support.
Well, thank you for that.
You know, my parting thoughts as I leave command and I leave installation command was just what an awesome opportunity I had to work with some amazing people and really support the Army's initiatives to make sure that we have a ready platform for our units to come train and build readiness. And in doing so, it has just been a tremendous experience, probably an experience of a lifetime. There's none other like it. And I'm just thankful for the opportunity and to work with everybody and do such great work.
Awesome. Proud to serve.
Yeah. Thank you, sir.
Yeah. All right. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Fort Hunter Liggett. We've been speaking with Garrison Colonel Charles Bell.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway. With a focus on rural communities, such as Leaper's Fork, not far from Nashville, the Big Backyard journey traverses through Tennessee's southwest quarter down into Alabama's legendary Shoals region, the mothership of American music. The featured rural community's common thread is historic architecture and a timeless, charming small-town atmosphere, some with a river running through it. The diverse attractions of the featured communities include the amazing Elephant Sanctuary in Hohenwald, where retired circus elephants come to retire in peace, and iconic destinations like Northern Alabama's Shoals region, where you'll find one of America's most iconic Frank Lloyd Wright homes and two of America's legendary recording studios that have been etching American soundtracks since the early 1960s. For example, Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, opened in 1969, instantly started marking up the charts with number one hits by recording artists like the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, Wilson Pickett, Linda Ronstadt, Rod Stewart, and Paul Simon. Nashville's Big Backyard's ardent promoters include Mike Wolfe, host of History Channel's American Pickers TV series, who provides a surgical contextual lens focused on Nashville's Big Backyard's diverse initiatives, and Liz McLaurin, president of the Land Trust for Tennessee, an equally passionate supporter of Nashville's Big Backyard's greater good elements through the Land Trust Preservation Initiatives. To learn more about the program, log on to nashvillesbigbackyard.org.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.